This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Kane Chronicles, Book 1, The Red Pyramid, by Rick Riordan. Performed by Kevin R. Free and Catherine Kellgren. To all my librarian friends, champions of books, true magicians in the House of Life, without you, this writer would be lost in the Duat. Warning. The following is a digital recording. Listen carefully for the verbal descriptions of important symbols. Background noises such as scuffling, hitting, and cursing by the two speakers have been edited out. The author makes no claims for the authenticity of the recording. It seems impossible that the two young narrators are telling the truth, but you, the listener, must decide for yourself.
1. A Death at the Needle. We only have a few hours, so listen carefully. If you're hearing this story, you're already in danger. Sadie and I might be your only chance. Go to the school. Find the locker. I won't tell you which school or which locker, because if you're the right person, you'll find it. The combination is 13, 32, 33. By the time you finish listening, you'll know what those numbers mean. Just remember, the story we're about to tell you isn't complete yet. How it ends will depend on you. The most important thing? When you open the package and find what's inside, don't keep it longer than a week. Sure, it'll be tempting. I mean, it will grant you almost unlimited power. But if you possess it too long, it will consume you. Learn its secrets quickly and pass it on. Hide it for the next person, the way Sadie and I did for you. Then be prepared for your life to get very interesting. Okay, Sadie is telling me to stop stalling and get on with the story. Fine. I guess it started in London, the night our dad blew up the British Museum. My name is Carter Kane. I'm 14, and my home is a suitcase. You think I'm kidding? Since I was 8 years old, my dad and I have traveled the world. I was born in L.A., but my dad's an archaeologist, so his work takes him all over. Mostly we go to Egypt, since that's his specialty. Go into a bookstore, find a book about Egypt, there's a pretty good chance it was written by Dr. Julius Kane. You want to know how Egyptians pulled the brains out of mummies, or built the pyramids, or cursed King Tut's tomb? My dad is your man. Of course, there are other reasons my dad moved around so much, but I didn't know his secret back then. I didn't go to school. My dad homeschooled me, if you can call it homeschooling when you don't have a home. He sort of taught me whatever he thought was important, so I learned a lot about Egypt, and basketball stats, and my dad's favorite musicians. I read a lot, too, pretty much anything I could get my hands on, from dad's history books to fantasy novels. Because I spent a lot of time sitting around in hotels and airports and dig sites in foreign countries where I didn't know anybody. My dad was always telling me to put the book down and play some ball. You ever try to start a game of pickup basketball in Aswan, Egypt? It's not easy. Anyway, my dad trained me early to keep all my possessions in a single suitcase that fits in an airplane's overhead compartment. My dad packed the same way, except he was allowed an extra work bag for his archaeology tools. Rule number one, I was not allowed to look in his work bag. That's a rule I never broke, until the day of the explosion. It happened on Christmas Eve. We were in London for visitation day with my sister, Sadie. See, Dad's only allowed 2 days a year with her, one in the winter, one in the summer, because our grandparents hate him. After our mom died, her parents, our grandparents, had this big court battle with Dad. After 6 lawyers, 2 fistfights, and a near-fatal attack with a spatula, don't ask, they won the right to keep Sadie with them in England. She was only 6, 2 years younger than me, and they couldn't keep us both. At least, that was their excuse for not taking me. So Sadie was raised as a British school kid, and I traveled around with my dad. We only saw Sadie 2x a year, which was fine with me. Shut up, Sadie. Yes, I'm getting to that part. So, anyway, my dad and I had just flown into Heathrow after a couple of delays. It was a drizzly, cold afternoon. The whole taxi ride into the city, my dad seemed kind of nervous. Now, my dad is a big guy. You wouldn't think anything could make him nervous. He has dark brown skin like mine, piercing brown eyes, a bald head, and a goatee, so he looks like a buff, evil scientist. That afternoon, he wore his cashmere winter coat and his best brown suit, the one he used for public lectures. Usually, he exudes so much confidence that he dominates any room he walks into, but sometimes, like that afternoon, I saw another side to him that I didn't really understand. He kept looking over his shoulder like we were being hunted. "Dad," I said as we were getting off the A-40, "what's wrong?" "No sign of them," he muttered. Then he must have realized he'd spoken aloud, because he looked at me kind of startled. "Nothing, Carter. Everything's fine." Which bothered me because my dad's a terrible liar. I always knew when he was hiding something, but I also knew no amount of pestering would get the truth out of him. He was probably trying to protect me, though from what, I didn't know. Sometimes I wondered if he had some dark secret in his past, some old enemy following him, maybe. But the idea seemed ridiculous. Dad was just an archaeologist. The other thing that troubled me? Dad was clutching his work bag. Usually when he does that, it means we're in danger. Like the time gunmen stormed our hotel in Cairo. I heard shots coming from the lobby and ran downstairs to check on my dad. By the time I got there, he was just calmly zipping up his work bag while three unconscious gunmen hung by their feet from the chandelier, their robes falling over their heads so you could see their boxer shorts. Dad claimed not to have witnessed anything, and in the end, the police blamed a freak chandelier malfunction. Another time, we got caught in a riot in Paris. My dad found the nearest parked car, pushed me into the back seat, and told me to stay down. I pressed myself against the floorboards and kept my eyes shut tight. I could hear Dad in the driver's seat, rummaging in his bag, mumbling something to himself while the mob yelled and destroyed things outside. A few minutes later, he told me it was safe to get up. Every other car on the block had been overturned and set on fire. Our car had been freshly washed and polished, and several 20-euro notes had been tucked under the windshield wipers. Anyway, I'd come to respect the bag. It was our good luck charm. But when my dad kept it close, it meant we were going to need good luck. We drove through the city center, heading east toward my grandparents' flat. We passed the golden gates of Buckingham Palace, the big stone column at Trafalgar Square. London is a pretty cool place, but after you've traveled for so long, all cities start to blend together. Other kids I meet sometimes say, "Wow, you're so lucky you get to travel so much." But it's not like we spend our time sightseeing or have a lot of money to travel in style. We've stayed in some pretty rough places, and we hardly ever stay anywhere longer than a few days. Most of the time, it feels like we're fugitives rather than tourists. I mean, you wouldn't think my dad's work was dangerous. He does lectures on topics like, "Can Egyptian magic really kill you?" and "Favorite punishments in the Egyptian underworld," and other stuff most people wouldn't care about. But like I said, there's that other side to him. He's always very cautious, checking every hotel room before he lets me walk into it. He'll dart into a museum to see some artifacts, take a few notes, and rush out again like he's afraid to be caught on the security cameras. One time when I was younger, we raced across the Charles de Gaulle airport to catch a last-minute flight, and Dad didn't relax until the plane was off the ground. I asked him point-blank what he was running from, and he looked at me like I just pulled the pin out of a grenade. For a second, I was scared he might actually tell me the truth. Then he said, "Carter, it's nothing." As if nothing were the most terrible thing in the world. After that, I decided maybe it was better not to ask questions. My grandparents, the Fausts, live in a housing development near Canary Wharf, right on the banks of the River Thames. The taxi let us off at the curb, and my dad asked the driver to wait. We were halfway up the walk when Dad froze. He turned and looked behind us. What? I asked. Then I saw the man in the trench coat. He was across the street, leaning against a big, dead tree. He was barrel-shaped, with skin the color of roasted coffee. His coat and black pinstriped suit looked expensive. He had long braided hair and wore a black fedora pulled down low over his dark round glasses. He reminded me of a jazz musician, the kind my dad would always drag me to see in concert. Even though I couldn't see his eyes, I got the impression he was watching us. He might have been an old friend or colleague of Dad's. No matter where we went, Dad was always running into people he knew. But it did seem strange that the guy was waiting here, outside my grandparents. And he didn't look happy. Carter, my dad said, go on ahead, but get your sister. I'll meet you back at the taxi. He crossed the street toward the man in the trench coat, which left me with two choices. Follow my dad and see what was going on, or do what I was told. I decided on the slightly less dangerous path. I went to retrieve my sister. Before I could even knock, Sadie opened the door. Late as usual, she said. She was holding her cat, Muffin, who'd been a going-away gift from Dad 6 years before. Muffin never seemed to get older or bigger. She had fuzzy yellow and black fur like a miniature leopard, alert yellow eyes, and pointy ears that were too tall for her head. A silver Egyptian pendant dangled from her collar. She didn't look anything like a muffin, but Sadie had been little when she named her, so I guess you have to cut her some slack. Sadie hadn't changed much either since last summer. As I'm recording this, she's standing next to me, glaring, so I'd better be careful how I describe her. You would never guess she's my sister. First of all, she'd been living in England so long, she has a British accent. Second, she takes after our mom, who was white, so Sadie's skin is much lighter than mine. She has straight, caramel-colored hair, not exactly blonde, but not brown, which she usually dyes with streaks of bright colors. That day it had red streaks down the left side. Her eyes are blue. I'm serious. Blue eyes, just like our mom's. She's only 12, but she's exactly as tall as me, which is really annoying. She was chewing gum, as usual, dressed for her day out with Dad in battered jeans, a leather jacket, and combat boots, like she was going to a concert and was hoping to stomp on some people. She had headphones dangling around her neck, in case we bored her. Okay, she didn't hit me, so I guess I did an okay job of describing her. Our plane was late, I told her. She popped a bubble, rubbed Muffin's head, and tossed the cat inside. Gran, going out! From somewhere in the house, Grandma Faust said something I couldn't make out, probably, don't let them in! Sadie closed the door and regarded me as if I were a dead mouse her cat had just dragged in. So, here you are again. Yep. Come on, then, she sighed. Let's get on with it. That's the way she was. No, hi, how you been the last 6 months? So glad to see you, or anything. But that was okay with me. When you only see each other twice a year, it's like you're distant cousins rather than siblings. We had absolutely nothing in common except our parents. We trudged down the steps. I was thinking how she smelled like a combination of old people's house and bubblegum when she stopped so abruptly I ran into her. Who's that? She asked. I'd almost forgotten about the dude in the trench coat. He and my dad were standing across the street next to the big tree, having what looked like a serious argument. Dad's back was turned so I couldn't see his face, but he gestured with his hands like he does when he's agitated. The other guy scowled and shook his head. Dunno, I said. He was there when we pulled up.
He looks familiar.
Sadie frowned like she was trying to remember.
Come on.
Dad wants us to wait in the cab, I said, even though I knew it was no use. Sadie was already on the move. Instead of going straight across the street, she dashed up the sidewalk for half a block, ducking behind cars, then crossed to the opposite side and crouched under a low stone wall. She started sneaking toward our dad. I didn't have much choice but to follow her example, even though it made me feel kind of stupid. 6 years in England, I muttered. and she thinks she's James Bond. Sadie swatted me without looking back and kept creeping forward. A couple more steps, and we were right behind the big dead tree. I could hear my dad on the other side saying,
"Have to, Amos. You know it's the right thing."
"No," said the other man, who must have been Amos. His voice was deep and even, very insistent. His accent was American.
"If I don't stop you, Julius, they will. The Père Ankh is shadowing you."
Sadie turned to me and mouthed the words, "Pear what?" I shook my head, just as mystified.
"Let's get out of here," I whispered,
because I figured we'd be spotted any minute and get in serious trouble. Sadie, of course, ignored me.
"They don't know my plan,"
my father was saying.
"By the time they figure it out, and the children,"
Amos asked. The hairs stood up on the back of my neck.
"What about them?" "I've made arrangements to protect them,"
my dad said.
"Besides, if I don't do this, we're all in danger. Now back off." "I can't, Julius." "Then it's a duel you want?"
Dad's tone turned deadly serious.
"You never could beat me, Amos."
I hadn't seen my dad get violent since the Great Spatula incident, and I wasn't anxious to see a repeat of that, but the two men seemed to be edging toward a fight. Before I could react, Sadie popped up and shouted, "Dad!" He looked surprised when she tackle-hugged him, but not nearly as surprised as the other guy, Amos. He backed up so quickly he tripped over his own trench coat. He'd taken off his glasses. I couldn't help thinking that Sadie was right. He did look familiar, like a very distant memory.
I must be going," he said.
He straightened his fedora and lumbered down the road. Our dad watched him go. He kept one arm protectively around Sadie and one hand inside the work bag slung over his shoulder. Finally, when Amos disappeared around the corner, Dad relaxed. He took his hand out of the bag and smiled at Sadie.
"Hello, sweetheart."
Sadie pushed away from him and crossed her arms.
"Oh, now it's sweetheart, is it? You're late. Visitation day's nearly over. And what was that about? Who's Amos? And what's the Père Ankh?"
Dad stiffened. He glanced at me like he was wondering how much we'd overheard.
"It's nothing," he said, trying to sound upbeat. "I have a wonderful evening planned. Who'd like a private tour of the British Museum?"
Sadie slumped in the back of the taxi between Dad and me.
"I can't believe it," she grumbled. "One evening together, and you want to do research."
Dad tried for a smile.
"Sweetheart, it'll be fun. The curator of the Egyptian collection personally invited—"
"Right, big surprise."
Sadie blew a strand of red-streaked hair out of her face.
"Christmas Eve, and we're going to see some moldy old relics from Egypt. Do you ever think about anything else?"
Dad didn't get mad. He never gets mad at Sadie. He just stared out the window at the darkening sky and the rain.
"Yes," he said quietly, "I do."
Whenever Dad got quiet like that and stared off into nowhere, I knew he was thinking about our mom. The last few months it had been happening a lot. I'd walk into our hotel room and find him with his cell phone in his hands, Mom's picture smiling up at him from the screen, her hair tucked under a headscarf, her blue eyes startlingly bright against the desert backdrop. Or we'd be at some dig site. I'd see Dad staring at the horizon, and I'd know he was remembering how he'd met her. Two young scientists in the Valley of the Kings on a dig to discover a lost tomb. Dad was an Egyptologist, Mom was an anthropologist looking for ancient DNA. He told me the story 1,000 times. Our taxi snaked its way along the banks of the Thames. Just past Waterloo Bridge, my dad tensed.
"Driver," he said, "stop here a moment."
The cabbie pulled over on the Victoria embankment.
"What is it, Dad?" I asked.
He got out of the cab like he hadn't heard me. When Sadie and I joined him on the sidewalk, he was staring up at Cleopatra's Needle. In case you've never seen it, the Needle is an obelisk, not a needle, and it doesn't have anything to do with Cleopatra. I guess the British just thought the name sounded cool when they brought it to London.
It's about 70 feet tall, which would have been really impressive back in ancient Egypt, but on the Thames, with all the tall buildings around, it looks small and sad. You could drive right by it and not even realize you just passed something that was 1,000 years older than the city of London.
God! Sadie walked around in a frustrated circle. Do we have to stop for every monument?
My dad stared at the top of the obelisk.
I had to see it again, he murmured. Where it happened.
A freezing wind blew off the river. I wanted to get back in the cab, but my dad was really starting to worry me. I'd never seen him so distracted.
What, Dad?
I asked. What happened here?
The last place I saw her.
Sadie stopped pacing. She scowled at me uncertainly, then back at Dad.
Hang on. Do you mean Mum?
Dad brushed Sadie's hair behind her ear, and she was so surprised she didn't even push him away. I felt like the rain had frozen me solid. Mom's death had always been a forbidden subject. I knew she died in an accident in London. I knew my grandparents blamed my dad, but no one would ever tell us the details. I'd given up asking my dad, partly because it made him so sad, partly because he absolutely refused to tell me anything. When you're older, was all he would say, which was the most frustrating response ever. You're telling us she died here? I said. At Cleopatra's Needle? What happened? He lowered his head.
Dad!
Sadie protested.
I go past this every day, and you mean to say all this time, and I didn't even know?
Do you still have your cat? Dad asked her, which seemed like a really stupid question.
Of course I've still got the cat, she said. What does that have to do with anything?
And your amulet. Sadie's hand went to her neck. When we were little, right before Sadie went to live with our grandparents, Dad had given us both Egyptian amulets. Mine was an Eye of Horus, which was a popular protection symbol in ancient Egypt. In fact, my dad says the modern pharmacist symbol, RX, is a simplified version of the Eye of Horus, because medicine is supposed to protect you. Anyway, I always wore my amulet under my shirt, but I figured Sadie would have lost hers, or thrown it away. To my surprise, she nodded,
"Course I have it, Dad, but don't change the subject. Gran's always going on about how you caused Mum's death. That's not true, is it?"
We waited. For once, Sadie and I wanted exactly the same thing. The truth.
The night your mother died, my father started. Here at the Needle.
A sudden flash illuminated the embankment. I turned, half blind, and just for a moment I glimpsed two figures. A tall, pale man with a forked beard and wearing cream-colored robes, and a coppery-skinned girl in dark blue robes and a headscarf, the kind of clothes I'd seen hundreds of times in Egypt. They were just standing there, side by side, not 20 feet away, watching us. Then the light faded. The figures melted into a fuzzy afterimage. When my eyes readjusted to the darkness, they were gone.
Sadie said nervously. Did you just see that?
Get in the cab, my dad said, pushing us toward the curb. We're out of time.
From that point on, Dad clammed up.
This isn't the place to talk, he said, glancing behind us.
He'd promised the cabbie an extra 10 pounds if he got us to the museum in under 5 minutes, and the cabbie was doing his best.
Dad, I tried, those people at the river. And the other bloke, Amos, Sadie said, are they Egyptian police or something?
Look, both of you, Dad said, I'm going to need your help tonight. I know it's hard, but you have to be patient. I'll explain everything, I promise, after we get to the museum. I'm going to make everything right again.
What do you mean? Sadie insisted. Make what right?
Dad's expression was more than sad. It was almost guilty. With a chill, I thought about what Sadie had said, about our grandparents blaming him for Mom's death. That couldn't be what he was talking about, could it? The cabbie swerved onto Great Russell Street and screeched to a halt in front of the museum's main gates. Just follow my lead, Dad told us. When we meet the curator, act normal. I was thinking that Sadie never acted normal, but I decided not to say anything. We climbed out of the cab. I got our luggage while Dad paid the driver with a big wad of cash. Then he did something strange. He threw a handful of small objects into the back seat. They looked like stones, but it was too dark for me to be sure. "Keep driving," he told the cabbie. "Take us to Chelsea." That made no sense since we were already out of the cab, but the driver sped off. I glanced at Dad, then back at the cab, and before it turned the corner and disappeared in the dark, I caught a weird glimpse of three passengers in the back seat, a man and two kids. I blinked. There was no way the cab could have picked up another fare so fast. "Dad?"
"London cabs don't stay empty very long," he said matter-of-factly. "Come along, kids."
He marched off through the wrought iron gates. For a second, Sadie and I hesitated.
"Carter, what is going on?"
I shook my head. "I'm not sure I want to know."
"Well, stay out here in the cold if you want, but I'm not leaving without an explanation."
She turned and marched after our dad. Looking back on it, I should have run. I should have dragged Sadie out of there and gotten as far away as possible. Instead, I followed her through the gates. 2. An explosion for Christmas. I'd been to the British Museum before. In fact, I've been in more museums than I like to admit. It makes me sound like a total geek. That's Sadie in the background, yelling that I am a total geek. Thanks, sis. Anyway, the museum was closed and completely dark, but the curator and two security guards were waiting for us on the front steps.
"Dr. Kane!"
The curator was a greasy little dude in a cheap suit. I'd seen mummies with more hair and better teeth. He shook my dad's hand like he was meeting a rock star.
"Your last paper on Imhotep. Brilliant! I don't know how you translated those spells."
"Imho who?" Sadie muttered to me. "Imhotep," I said. "High priest, architect. Some say he was a magician. Designed the first step pyramid. You know."
"Don't know," Sadie said. "Don't care. But thanks."
Dad expressed his gratitude to the curator for hosting us on a holiday. Then he put his hand on my shoulder. "Dr. Martin, I'd like you to meet Carter and Sadie."
"Ah, your son, obviously, and..."
The curator looked hesitantly at Sadie.
"And this young lady?"
"My daughter," Dad said. Dr. Martin's stare went temporarily blank. Doesn't matter how open-minded or polite people think they are, there's always that moment of confusion that flashes across their faces when they realize Sadie is part of our family. I hate it, but over the years I've come to expect it. The curator regained his smile.
"Yes, yes, of course. Right this way, Dr. Kane. We're very honored."
The security guards locked the doors behind us. They took our luggage. Then one of them reached for Dad's work bag.
No, Dad said with a tight smile. "I'll keep this one."
The guards stayed in the foyer as we followed the curator into the great court. It was ominous at night. Dim light from the glass-domed ceiling cast cross-hatched shadows across the walls like a giant spider web. Our footsteps clicked on the white marble floor.
"So," Dad said, "the stone."
"Yes," the curator said, "though I can't imagine what new information you could glean from it. It's been studied to death, our most famous artifact, of course."
"Of course," Dad said, "but you may be surprised."
"What's he on about now?"
Sadie whispered to me. I didn't answer. I had a sneaking suspicion what stone they were talking about, but I couldn't figure out why Dad would drag us out on Christmas Eve to see it. I wondered what he'd been about to tell us at Cleopatra's Needle. Something about our mother and the night she died. And why did he keep glancing around as if he expected those strange people we'd seen at the Needle to pop up again? We were locked in a museum, surrounded by guards and high-tech security. Nobody could bother us in here. I hoped. We turned left into the Egyptian wing. The walls were lined with massive statues of the pharaohs and gods, but my dad bypassed them all and went straight for the main attraction in the middle of the room.
"Beautiful," my father murmured.
"And it's not a replica."
"No, no," the curator promised. "We don't always keep the actual stone on display, but for you..." This is quite real.
We were staring at a slab of dark gray rock, about 3 feet tall and 2 feet wide. It sat on a pedestal, encased in a glass box. The flat surface of the stone was chiseled with 3 distinct bands of writing. The top part was ancient Egyptian picture writing, hieroglyphics. The middle section, I had to rack my brain to remember what my dad called it, demotic, a kind of writing from the period when the Greeks controlled Egypt and a lot of Greek words got mixed into Egyptian. The last lines were in Greek. "The Rosetta Stone," I said.
"Isn't that a computer program?" Sadie asked.
I wanted to tell her how stupid she was, but the curator cut me off with a nervous laugh.
"Young lady, the Rosetta Stone was the key to deciphering hieroglyphics. It was discovered by Napoleon's army in 1799, and..."
"Oh, right," Sadie said. "I remember now."
I knew she was just saying that to shut him up, but my dad wouldn't let it go. "Sadie," he said, "until this stone was discovered, regular mortals, no one had been able to read hieroglyphics for centuries. The written language of Egypt had been completely forgotten. Then an Englishman named Thomas Young proved that the Rosetta Stone's 3 languages all conveyed the same message. A Frenchman named Champollion took up the work and cracked the code of hieroglyphics."
Sadie chewed her gum, unimpressed. "What's it say, then?"
Dad shrugged. "Nothing important. It's basically a thank you letter from some priests to King Ptolemy V. When it was first carved, the stone was no big deal, but over the centuries, it has become a powerful symbol, perhaps the most important connection between ancient Egypt and the modern world. I was a fool not to realize its potential sooner."
He'd lost me, and apparently the curator too. "Dr. Kane," he asked, "are you quite all right?"
Dad breathed deeply. "My apologies, Dr. Martin. I was just thinking aloud. If I could have the glass removed, and if you could bring me the papers I asked for from your archives." Dr. Martin nodded. He pressed a code into a small remote control, and the front of the glass box clicked open.
"It will take a few minutes to retrieve the notes," Dr. Martin said. "For anyone else, I would hesitate to grant unguarded access to the stone, as you've requested. I trust you'll be careful."
He glanced at us kids like we were troublemakers.
"We'll be careful," Dad promised.
As soon as Dr. Martin's steps receded, Dad turned to us with a frantic look in his eyes.
"Children, this is very important. You have to stay out of this room."
He slipped his work bag off his shoulder and unzipped it just enough to pull out a bike chain and padlock.
"Follow Dr. Martin. You'll find his office at the end of the great court on the left. There's only one entrance. Once he's inside, wrap this around the door handles and lock it tight. We need to delay him."
"You want us to lock him in?"
Sadie asked, suddenly interested.
"Brilliant!"
"Dad," I said, "what's going on?"
"We don't have time for explanations," he said. "This will be our only chance. They're coming."
"Who's coming?" Sadie asked.
He took Sadie by the shoulders. "Sweetheart, I love you, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry for many things, but there's no time now. If this works, I promise I'll make everything better for all of us. Carter, you're my brave man. You have to trust me. Remember, lock up Dr. Martin, then stay out of this room."
Chaining the curator's door was easy. But as soon as we'd finished, we looked back the way we'd come and saw blue light streaming from the Egyptian gallery, as if our dad had installed a giant glowing aquarium. Sadie locked eyes with me.
"Honestly, do you have any idea what he's up to?"
"None," I said. "But he's been acting strange lately, thinking a lot about Mom. He keeps her picture."
I didn't want to say more. Fortunately, Sadie nodded like she understood.
"What's in his work bag?" she asked.
"I don't know. He told me never to look." Sadie raised an eyebrow.
"And you never did? God, that is so like you, Carter. You're hopeless."
I wanted to defend myself, but just then a tremor shook the floor. Startled, Sadie grabbed my arm.
"He told us to stay put. I suppose you're going to follow that order, too.
Actually, that order was sounding pretty good to me. But Sadie sprinted down the hall, and after a moment's hesitation, I ran after her. When we reached the entrance of the Egyptian gallery, we stopped dead in our tracks. Our dad stood in front of the Rosetta Stone with his back to us. A blue circle glowed on the floor around him as if someone had switched on hidden neon tubes in the floor. My dad had thrown off his overcoat. His work bag lay open at his feet, revealing a wooden box about 2 feet long, painted with Egyptian images.
"What's he holding?" Sadie whispered to me. "Is that a boomerang?"
Sure enough, when Dad raised his hand, he was brandishing a curved white stick. It did look like a boomerang. But instead of throwing the stick, he touched it to the Rosetta Stone. Sadie caught her breath. Dad was writing on the stone. Wherever the boomerang made contact, glowing blue lines appeared on the granite. Hieroglyphs. It made no sense. How could he write glowing words with a stick? But the image was bright and clear. Ram's horns above a box and an X.
"Open," Sadie murmured.
I stared at her because it sounded like she had just translated the word, but that was impossible. I'd been hanging around Dad for years, and even I could read only a few hieroglyphs. They are seriously hard to learn. Dad raised his arms. He chanted, "Wosa, Ia," and two more hieroglyphic symbols burned blue against the surface of the Rosetta Stone. As stunned as I was, I recognized the first symbol. It was the name of the Egyptian god of the dead.
"Woser," I whispered.
I'd never heard it pronounced that way, but I knew what it meant. Osiris.
"Osiris, come,"
Sadie said, as if in a trance. Then her eyes widened.
"No," she shouted. "Dad, no!"
Our father turned in surprise. He started to say, "Children," but it was too late. The ground rumbled, the blue light turned to searing white, and the Rosetta Stone exploded. When I regained consciousness, the first thing I heard was laughter. Horrible, gleeful laughter mixed with the blare of the museum's security alarms. I felt like I'd just been run over by a tractor. I sat up, dazed, and spit a piece of Rosetta Stone out of my mouth. The gallery was in ruins. Waves of fire rippled in pools along the floor. Giant statues had toppled. Sarcophagi had been knocked off their pedestals. Pieces of the Rosetta Stone had exploded outward with such force that they'd embedded themselves in the columns, the walls, the other exhibits. Sadie was passed out next to me, but she looked unharmed. I shook her shoulder and she grunted, "Ugh." In front of us, where the Rosetta Stone had been, stood a smoking, sheared-off pedestal. The floor was blackened in a starburst pattern, except for the glowing blue circle around our father. He was facing our direction, but he didn't seem to be looking at us. A bloody cut ran across his scalp. He gripped the boomerang tightly. I didn't understand what he was looking at. Then the horrible laughter echoed around the room again, and I realized it was coming from right in front of me. Something stood between our father and us. At first I could barely make it out, just a flicker of heat. But as I concentrated, it took on a vague form, the fiery outline of a man. He was taller than Dad, and his laugh cut through me like a chainsaw.
"Well done," he said to my father. "Very well done, Julius."
"You were not summoned." My father's voice trembled. He held up the boomerang, but the fiery man flicked one finger, and the stick flew from Dad's hand, shattering against the wall.
"I am never summoned, Julius," the man purred. "But when you open a door, you must be prepared for guests to walk through."
"Back to the Duat,"
my father roared.
"I have the power of the great king."
"Oh, scary,"
the fiery man said with amusement.
"And even if you knew how to use that power, which you do not, he was never my match.
I am the strongest. Now you will share his fate.
I couldn't make sense of anything, but I knew that I had to help my dad. I tried to pick up the nearest chunk of stone, but I was so terrified my fingers felt frozen and numb. My hands were useless. Dad shot me a silent look of warning. Get out. I realized he was intentionally keeping the fiery man's back to us, hoping Sadie and I would escape unnoticed. Sadie was still groggy. I managed to drag her behind a column into the shadows. When she started to protest, I clamped my hand over her mouth. That woke her up. She saw what was happening and stopped fighting. Alarms blared. Fire circled around the doorways of the gallery. The guards had to be on their way, but I wasn't sure if that was a good thing for us. Dad crouched to the floor, keeping his eyes on his enemy, and opened his painted wooden box. He brought out a small rod, like a ruler. He muttered something under his breath, and the rod elongated into a wooden staff as tall as he was. Sadie made a squeaking sound. I couldn't believe my eyes either, but things only got weirder. Dad threw his staff at the fiery man's feet, and it changed into an enormous serpent, 10 feet long and as big around as I was, with coppery scales and glowing red eyes. It lunged at the fiery man, who effortlessly grabbed the serpent by its neck. The man's hand burst into white-hot flames, and the snake burned to ashes.
"An old trick, Julius,"
the fiery man chided. My dad glanced at us, silently urging us again to run. Part of me refused to believe any of this was real. Maybe I was unconscious, having a nightmare. Next to me, Sadie picked up a chunk of stone.
"How many?" my dad asked quickly, trying to keep the fiery man's attention. "How many did I release?"
"Why, all 5.
The man said, as if explaining something to a child.
"You should know we're a package deal, Julius. Soon I'll release even more, and they'll be very grateful. I shall be named king again."
"The demon days," my father said. "They'll stop you before it's too late."
The fiery man laughed.
"You think the house can stop me? Those old fools can't even stop arguing among themselves. Now, let the story be told anew, and this time you shall never rise."
The fiery man waved his hand. The blue circle at Dad's feet went dark. Dad grabbed for his toolbox, but it skittered across the floor.
"Goodbye, Osiris,"
the fiery man said. With another flick of his hand, he conjured a glowing coffin around our dad. At first it was transparent, but as our father struggled and pounded on its sides, the coffin became more and more solid, a golden Egyptian sarcophagus inlaid with jewels. My dad caught my eyes one last time and mouthed the word "run" before the coffin sank into the floor as if the ground had turned to water.
"Dad!" I screamed.
Sadie threw her stone, but it sailed harmlessly through the fiery man's head. He turned, and for one terrible moment, his face appeared in the flames. What I saw made no sense. It was as if someone had superimposed 2 different faces on top of each other. One almost human, with pale skin, cruel, angular features, and glowing red eyes. The other like an animal with dark fur and sharp fangs. Worse than a dog or wolf or a lion. Some animal I'd never seen before. Those red eyes stared at me, and I knew I was going to die. Behind me, heavy footsteps echoed on the marble floor of the great court. Voices were barking orders. The security guards, maybe the police, but they'd never get here in time. The fiery man lunged at us. A few inches from my face, something shoved him backward. The air sparked with electricity. The amulet around my neck grew uncomfortably hot. The fiery man hissed, regarding me more carefully.
"So, It's you.
The building shook again. At the opposite end of the room, part of the wall exploded in a brilliant flash of light. Two people stepped through the gap. The man and the girl we'd seen at the needle, their robes swirling around them. Both of them held staffs. The fiery man snarled. He looked at me one last time and said, "Soon, boy." Then the entire room erupted in flames. A blast of heat sucked all the air out of my lungs, and I crumpled to the floor. The last thing I remember, the man with the forked beard and the girl in blue were standing over me. I heard the security guards running and shouting, getting closer. The girl crouched over me and drew a long, curved knife from her belt.
"We must act quickly," she told the man.
"Not yet," he said with some reluctance. His thick accent sounded French.
"We must be sure before we destroy them."
I closed my eyes and drifted into unconsciousness.
3. Imprisoned with my cat. "Give me the bloody mic. Hello, Sadie here. My brother's a rubbish storyteller, sorry about that, but now you've got me, so all is well. Let's see. The explosion, Rosetta Stone in a billion pieces, fiery evil bloke, dad boxed in a coffin, creepy Frenchman and Arab girl with the knife, us passing out. Right. So, when I woke up, the police were rushing about, as you might expect. They separated me from my brother. I didn't really mind that part, he's a pain anyway. But they locked me in the curator's office for ages. And yes, they used our bicycle chain to do it, cretins. I was shattered, of course. I'd just been knocked out by a fiery whatever it was. I'd watched my dad get packed in a sarcophagus and shot through the floor. I tried to tell the police about all that, but did they care? No. Worst of all, I had a lingering chill, as if someone was pushing ice-cold needles into the back of my neck. It had started when I looked at those blue glowing words Dad had drawn on the Rosetta Stone, and I knew what they meant. A family disease, perhaps? Can knowledge of boring Egyptian stuff be hereditary? With my luck. Long after my gum had gone stale, a policewoman finally retrieved me from the curator's office. She asked me no questions. She just trundled me into a police car and took me home. Even then, I wasn't allowed to explain to Gran and Gramps. The policewoman just tossed me into my room and I waited. And waited. I don't like waiting. I paced the floor. My room was nothing posh, just an attic space with a window and a bed and a desk. There wasn't much to do. Muffins sniffed my legs and her tail puffed up like a bottle brush. I suppose she doesn't fancy the smell of museums. She hissed and disappeared under the bed. "Thanks a lot," I muttered. I opened the door, but the policewoman was standing guard. "The inspector will be with you in a moment," she told me. "Please stay inside." I could see downstairs, just a glimpse of Gramps pacing the room, wringing his hands, while Carter and a police inspector talked on the sofa. I couldn't make out what they were saying. "Could I just use the loo?" I asked the nice officer. "No," she closed the door in my face. "As if I might rig an explosion in the toilet, honestly." I dug out my iPod and scrolled through my playlist. Nothing struck me. I threw it on my bed in disgust. When I'm too distracted for music, that is a very sad thing. I wondered why Carter got to talk to the police first. It wasn't fair. I fiddled with the necklace Dad had given me. I'd never been sure what the symbol meant. Carter's was obviously an eye, but mine looked a bit like an angel, or perhaps a killer alien robot. Why on earth had Dad asked if I still had it? Of course I still had it. It was the only gift he'd ever given me. Well, apart from Muffin, and with the cat's attitude, I'm not sure I would call her a proper gift. Dad had practically abandoned me at age 6, after all. The necklace was my one link to him. On good days, I would stare at it and remember him fondly. On bad days, which were much more frequent, I would fling it across the room and stomp on it and curse him for not being around, which I found quite therapeutic. But in the end, I always put it back on. At any rate, during the weirdness at the museum, and I'm not making this up, the necklace got hotter. I nearly took it off, but I couldn't help wondering if it truly was protecting me somehow. I'll make things right, Dad had said, with that guilty look he often gives me. Well, colossal fail, Dad. What had he been thinking? I wanted to believe it had all been a bad dream. The glowing hieroglyphs, the snake staff, the coffin. Things like that simply don't happen. But I knew better. I couldn't dream anything as horrifying as that fiery man's face when he turned on us. Soon, boy, he'd told Carter, as if he intended to track us down. Just the idea made my hands tremble. I also couldn't help wondering about our stop at Cleopatra's Needle, how Dad had insisted on seeing it, as if he was stealing his courage, as if what he did at the British Museum had something to do with my mum. My eyes wandered across my room and fixed on my desk. No, I thought, not going to do it. But I walked over and opened the drawer. I shoved aside a few old mags, my stash of sweets, a stack of maths homework I'd forgotten to hand in, and a few pictures of me and my mates, Liz and Emma, trying on ridiculous hats in Camden Market. And there, at the bottom of it all, was the picture of Mum. Gran and Gramps have loads of pictures. They keep a shrine to Ruby in the hall cupboard. Mum's childhood artwork, her O-level results, her graduation picture from university, her favourite jewellery. It's quite mental. I was determined not to be like them, living in the past. I barely remembered Mum, after all, and nothing could change the fact she was dead. But I did keep the one picture. It was of Mum and me at our house in Los Angeles, just after I was born. She stood out on the balcony, the Pacific Ocean behind her, holding a wrinkled, pudgy lump of baby that would some day grow up to be yours truly. Baby me was not much to look at, but Mum was gorgeous, even in shorts and a tattered T-shirt. Her eyes were deep blue, her blonde hair was clipped back, her skin was perfect. Quite depressing compared to mine. People always say I look like her, but I couldn't even get the spot off my chin, much less look so mature and beautiful. Stop smirking, Carter! The photo fascinated me because I hardly remembered our lives together at all. But the main reason I'd kept the photo was because of the symbol on Mum's T-shirt, one of those life symbols, an ankh. My dead mother wearing the symbol for life. Nothing could have been sadder. But she smiled at the camera as if she knew a secret, as if my dad and she were sharing a private joke. Something tugged at the back of my mind. That stocky man in the trench coat who'd been arguing with Dad across the street. He'd said something about the pair ankh. Had he meant ankh as in the symbol for life? And if so, what was a pair? I suppose he didn't mean pear, as in the fruit. I had an eerie feeling that if I saw the words pear, ankh, written in hieroglyphs, I would know what they meant. I put down the picture of Mum. I picked up a pencil and turned over one of my old homework papers. I wondered what would happen if I tried to draw the words pear, ankh. Would the right design just occur to me? As I touched pencil to paper, my bedroom door opened. "Miss Kane?" I whirled and dropped the pencil. A police inspector stood frowning in my doorway. "What are you doing?" "Maths," I said. My ceiling was quite low, so the inspector had to stoop to come in. He wore a lint-coloured suit that matched his grey hair and his ashen face.
"Now then, Sadie, I'm Chief Inspector Williams. Let's have a chat, shall we? Sit down."
I didn't sit, and neither did he, which must have annoyed him. It's hard to look in charge when you're hunched over like Quasimodo.
"Tell me everything, please," he said, "from the time your father came round to get you."
"I already told the police at the museum."
"Again, if you don't mind."
So I told him everything. Why not? His left eyebrow crept higher and higher as I told him the strange bits, like the glowing letters and serpent staff.
"Well, Sadie," Inspector Williams said, "you've got quite an imagination.
I'm not lying, Inspector, and I think your eyebrow is trying to escape. He tried to look at his own eyebrows, then scowled.
Now, Sadie, I'm sure this is very hard on you. I understand you want to protect your father's reputation, but he's gone now.
You mean through the floor in a coffin, I insisted. He's not dead. Inspector Williams spread his hands.
Sadie, I'm very sorry, but we must find out why he did this act of... well,
act of what? He cleared his throat uncomfortably.
Your father destroyed priceless artifacts and apparently killed himself in the process. We'd very much like to know why.
I stared at him. Are you saying my father's a terrorist? Are you mad?
We've made calls to some of your father's associates. I understand his behaviour has become erratic since your mother's death. He'd become withdrawn and obsessive in his studies, spending more and more time in Egypt.
He's a bloody Egyptologist. You should be looking for him, not asking stupid questions.
Sadie, he said,
and I could hear in his voice that he was resisting the urge to strangle me. Strangely, I get this a lot from adults.
There are extremist groups in Egypt that object to Egyptian artifacts being kept in other countries' museums. These people might have approached your father. Perhaps in his state, your father became an easy target for them. If you've heard him mention any names... I stormed past him to the window. I was so angry I could hardly think. I refused to believe Dad was dead. No, no, no. And a terrorist? Please. Why did adults have to be so thick? They always say, tell the truth, and when you do, they don't believe you. What's the point? I stared down at the dark street. Suddenly, that cold, tingly feeling got worse than ever. I focused on the dead tree where I'd met Dad earlier. Standing there now, in the dim light of a street lamp, looking up at me, was the pudgy bloke in the black trench coat and the round glasses and the fedora, the man Dad had called Amos. I suppose I should have felt threatened by an odd man staring up at me in the dark of night, but his expression was full of concern, and he looked so familiar. It was driving me mad that I couldn't remember why. Behind me, the inspector cleared his throat. Sadie, no one blames you for the attack on the museum. We understand you were dragged into this against your will.
I turned from the window. Against my will? I chained the curator in his office. The inspector's eyebrows started to creep up again.
Be that as it may, surely you didn't understand what your father meant to do. Possibly your brother was involved?
I snorted. Carter, please!
So you are determined to protect him as well? You consider him a proper brother, do you?
I couldn't believe it. I wanted to smack his face. What's that supposed to mean? Because he doesn't look like me?
The inspector blinked. I only meant...
I know what you meant. Of course he's my brother. Inspector Williams held up his hands apologetically, but I was still seething. As much as Carter annoyed me, I hated it when people assumed we weren't related, or looked at my father askance when he said the three of us were a family, like we'd done something wrong. Stupid Dr. Martin at the museum. Inspector Williams. It happened every time Dad and Carter and I were together. Every bloody time.
I'm sorry, Sadie, the inspector said. I only want to make sure we separate the innocent from the guilty. It will go much easier for everyone if you cooperate. Any information, anything your father said, people he might have mentioned.
Amos, I blurted out just to see his reaction. He met a man named Amos.
Inspector Williams sighed. Sadie, he couldn't have done. Surely you know that. We spoke with Amos not 1 hour ago on the phone from his home in New York.
He isn't in New York, I insisted. He's right... I glanced out the window and Amos was gone. Bloody typical. That's not possible, I said.
Exactly, the inspector said.
But he was here, I exclaimed. Who is he? One of Dad's colleagues? How did you know to call him?
Really, Sadie, this acting must stop.
Acting? The inspector studied me for a moment. then set his jaw as if he'd made a decision. "We've already had the truth from Carter. I didn't want to upset you, but he told us everything. He understands there's no point